Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your hostess with the mostest, Lady P. No relation to Master P. Today's guests are both new to the show, but certainly not new to the world of online film criticism. First up, she's the creator of the fantastic cinema blog, Sales on Film. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show, Miss Susie Sue Homemaker, Kristen Sales.
Hello.
Also with us is the creator of the website, cinemafanatic.com, as well as the Tumblr Old Films Flickr. Welcome to the show, international and domestic goddess, Miss Mariah E. Gates.
Hello.
On today's show, we're going to talk about the 36th greatest movie of all time, Jean Diamant, 23 Quai du Camels, 1004 von Bruxelles.
Yay! Yeah. Good job.
I'm probably going to call it Jean Dielman, just for the record. but Jean Diamant was directed by someone named Chantal Ackerman. I know what you're thinking. Chantal, but that's a girl's name. Why, yes, believe it or not, we finally have a sight and sound entry that was directed by a woman. And that works out nicely because one of our guests, Mariah, has vowed that in 2015 she will only watch movies made by females. This endeavor has a name and a hashtag. It's called A Year with Women. So for our second topic, we're going to talk about the project. Plus, we're going to discuss the film industry's legacy of gender inequality and the importance of representation. Woo! Huh?
Yeah.
It's going to be
fun. Sight.
or as I like to call it, Sunday at Mariah's house.
Right.
And just in case that wasn't fun enough, we're going to close things out with a few final notes of positivity. All right, ladies, you ready to do some empowering?
I'm always ready to peel these potatoes. Let's go.
Yeah, let's do it. First up, we have Chantal Ackerman's 1975 film, Jean Diamant. You know the rest. The film steps us through the life of a widowed mother named Jean Diamant, played by Delphine Seyrig. Seyrig. Hope I said that right. I think that's right. Seyrig.
It's probably Seyrig.
Seyrig. That's way better.
Yeah.
Her daily routine slowly unfolds before us. She folds, scrubs, cooks, greets son, serves, scrubs, folds, rinses, washes, repeats. Her life is a highly regimented schedule of chores and rituals. Though her workload does include one unusual task. For exactly 1 hour of every day, she works as a prostitute. She has a small roster of loyal clients whom she cycles through every week. Much like every other aspect of her life, this business runs like clockwork. That is until one morning she wakes up an hour early. This throws her whole system out of whack, and an unsettled Jean Diamant is a dangerous Jean Diamant. This film is considered a landmark achievement in both feminist cinema and slow cinema, but is it worthy of its esteem? We shall discuss. Okay. Do you like Jean Diamant? Mariah, let's start with you. Okay.
Yes.
Tell me why.
Oh, God. It took me, like, hours. I like Chantal Ackerman, period. I've seen, like, five of her films now. And this is very much her kind of film where it's all about the details and it's all about nuance and it's all about women and how women live their lives. But also interiors. She's really into the interiors, which I like because I am also into interiors. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it's one of those films where there's nothing else like it. Like, other than other films by Chantal Ackerman, so.
Right.
I like it for that.
Yeah, I had that same reaction. Like, I've never seen anything like this before. Kristen, how about you?
Yes, I do like this movie.
Okay.
For its singularity, as well as, I think, for the rigidity of the form, but also how it's just, like, she's just totally in control. I really am into, formalism and framing and long takes. That's sort of what I prefer in cinema, and this is just all about that. Mm-hmm. But it's I get the sense watching it, and I think your mileage may vary, but it's never like slow in a way that's designed to sort of necessarily like challenge the viewer or like sort of piss them off. Everything seems very controlled and purposeful. Mm. And I really like that in a filmmaker and in a film.
This film is over 3 hours, like 3 hours and 20 minutes, something like that.
200 minutes.
Yeah. And some have suggested that it's meant to be, it's intentionally a tedious film.
No, I don't think so.
Obviously not.
Yeah. No, I've seen it twice, and I like it more each time I watch it. Okay. I find it to be very pleasurable
to watch.
But, I mean, like I said, obviously, this is a very famous film for that reason, that so many people are like, this is the worst. And it's like they just can't handle it. So, but I think it's very, I don't know, I think a lot of slow cinema, especially that's very popular now, is like very, very tedious to the point of really pushing, like almost alienating the viewer. And this, I don't have that same reaction when I watch this.
Okay. Did you have any expectations going into the film?
I accidentally read a 2-sentence review that spoiled the movie. So I knew how it was going to end
right
before I saw it. And that sort of ruined it a little bit, because if I didn't know what was going to happen, I would have been like, what's going to happen? You know, like, what is the point? And I think that would have, I would have enjoyed it just a little bit more. But mostly I was just having seen another film of hers that's similar but not as long, Hotel Monterey, which also has no dialogue and goes for an hour, where you're just like, I was expecting to like want to turn on music halfway through it, and I didn't this time, so that was good.
Yeah. Kristen, do you have any expectations?
I had seen it before. I don't recall. I think it might have been in college, but I didn't know the ending when I saw it, so I was shocked the first time I saw it. I purposefully didn't read anything. I think it was the Criterion disc, so like I didn't even read the Criterion essay. Yeah. I read it after. And so no, this time I basically knew all the beats or whatever. I was just rewatching it in case there was anything that I wanted to remember, specific scenes. And I think what struck me this time is that I had sort of forgotten or blocked out all of the parts where she actually leaves her apartment. Anytime that she's outside, I forgot that she like runs all those errands. And my memory of the movie was basically just her sitting at that kitchen counter and making coffee. Because I remember the first time I saw this movie, it made me want to have coffee. And I think actually I had to pause the movie and make coffee and then drink coffee for the rest of the movie, because it was so like, you just, I don't know, you have a hankering, or I just like when you watch her, you know, make the veal cutlets, it's like, I want a veal cutlet.
Like, it's very I feel like I could enticing. Make, and I haven't eaten meat in like 12 years. I feel like I could make a meatloaf now.
Yeah, because like, you watch her step-by-step step
make
step
that
do
whole
it.
Meatloaf. I didn't know there was an egg in a meatloaf.
Totally. Yeah.
Dude, what?
I didn't know that. I don't know. I don't eat meat. Oh, I don't make meat. And I don't know how to make anything, but I could make a meatloaf now.
I think that's one of the things I love about the movie is that as she's performing these tasks, you actually see her do them. So often when you watch a movie, an actor has a piece of business and it's sort of an afterthought, but here she really commits.
Well, it's exactly that. It's a piece of business. This is the whole business. Yeah. The whole thing is her doing things.
I also appreciate that she actually consumes the food that she makes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anytime somebody is like cooking or at a restaurant or something in a movie and then they have a conversation and leave and the food has not been eaten, I'm like, dude, no one in real life doesn't eat their food when they order it.
Exactly. It's always distracting when there's food on screen, because it always looks good and nobody eats it. They like move it around the plate.
And again, that's one of the thing that's very unique about this movie, because all of the sort of window dressing elements of quote unquote real life that you see in fictionalized movies, like eating food or running errands or whatever, they're just sort of there to like intimate the regular schedules that normal people have, were so that, you know, as interstitials between whatever the plot is, and it's the whole movie. So it takes those elements that are sort of just in screenplays to fill time or to make a person seem relatable and builds an entire movie out of it.
Exactly.
So it is kind of, it's like jarring, because these things are never taken seriously.
I found the film really comforting.
Yeah,
she's so methodical.
You get into a rhythm. It's actually calming. I felt while I was watching it, I was like, I feel better.
Yeah, and also guilty because I'm not doing chores. Instead, I'm sitting and watching this thing.
It made me not ever want to do chores though, because really? She sets the table with the meticulously, and then she moves, when it's done, she moves it back, but then she's just gonna have to do it again tomorrow, and that is why I don't do chores, because it's like, cleaning, yes, but like, moving things because it's decorative, and then it's not, and then it's functional, like, I just want things to be functional, or decorative, not decorative, and functional. Mm. If I have a vase, it's not gonna be on my eating table.
Yeah, but the way that she structured her time so that to increase, it's just maximum efficiency.
Yeah, it's actually very, like, admirable because it made me sort of have a respect for the type of woman or the type of homemaker that does that, that allows herself to be so disciplined too. Because it is, there is that element, Mariah, of, like, the maddening thing where she just keeps taking, you know, cups out and then using the cup and then washing it and then doing it over again. It's like the lazy part of me is like, just leave the cup out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's like there is this other element of like, it's like I respect the way that like, or like as soon as she uses something, as soon as she uses the table, she wipes it down.
Mm-hmm. She took a bath and then immediately Ajaxed
it. I know.
It.
Well, like, that really bothered
me.
I've never
Ajaxed do that. My tub. Like,
that was the one.
Sorry, tub.
I don't know. That was the one part of the movie that I didn't believe.
That little detail, I like that because it says so much about her character, because nobody does that.
Yeah. And then at one point she Ajax the tub instead of taking a bath because she ran out of time.
Yeah.
And she was like, take a bath, she's clean already the bath, in take the a bath, clean the bath. She cleans the bath instead of taking a bath. Who makes that decision?
I know. I love – it's just the devil's in the details and everything is so – gives you so much insight into character, plot, narrative. It's like it's all tied into these – gestures. So every time you watch it, I think there's a new gesture that strikes a chord with you. Like this time I was watching it, I was like, I really like love my mom. Like I want to call my mom and like thank her for like making me dinner and like putting up with me when I like read at the table. You know, like you see yourself in this like garbage son, or you see yourself in Jean Zelman, and you're like, a lot of people live these lives where they basically just are working their entire life for another person,
right,
and that person doesn't acknowledge you. So, like, I think every time you watch this, there's a new resonance based on where you are in your life or how your rhythms or how your homemaking has changed.
Right. So. Yeah, she said she made this as a tribute to her mother, and also that it was heavily influenced by her Jewish upbringing.
Her mother was a Holocaust survivor,
right, exactly.
So there's a whole different sort of like how my grandparents were children of the Dust Bowl, and they came from Texas to California to not die of starvation, and so they were very regimented on how they ate. And then my dad is very regimented on how he eats, because you can't waste anything because depression, you know, and it's that same sort of thing, only with the mindset of a Holocaust survivor as opposed to a Depression-era kid.
Right. It didn't occur to me that that was a Jewish mindset, because that's – I mean, I guess no wonder this all feels very familiar, but
– But it's interesting, too, that it's you could be completely ignorant of Ackerman's intentions about making it about her mother or her mother's background, and it could still resonate with you. So it's – you know, you – That history, like, is a nice thing to know, but then I feel like all of these rhythms or this sort of behavior is universal enough, or even if it's not universal to your personal experience, you can still sort of, you know, understand just because so much is being communicated physically.
Yeah.
I also liked the one letter from her sister. I thought that was really a great personal note, because another one of her films that I've seen is Letters from Home, and it's various shots of New York as narrated by letters that her mother sent her. And so she's someone who knows what it's like to be that far from her family and to have letters and never write back. And the letters get sadder and sadder because she's like, how come you don't write me back? And it's like, there's the scene where she's like, I should write her back, but she doesn't know what to write. And it's like...
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I went into this film kind of knowing that it was a very important feminist work, maybe the feminist work, according to the Sight and Sound list. But it was made in the 1970s, and I thought that it might be a little bit retrograde and maybe a little bit dismissive of housework and the domestic space. And I was so delighted to find that that was not the case. It seems it's a celebration. If not a celebration, then at least there's a certain definite appreciation for the work that she's doing.
Yeah, it's a reverence and a respect.
Yeah,
exactly. It takes it very seriously.
Exactly, yeah. And One question I had as I was watching it, we see that the film is structured into three parts. Day one, day two, day three. On the second day, she wakes up an hour later and everything's thrown off. And gradually we see on the third day, things are off even more. But I couldn't quite tell what was the catalyst for the dissolution of the routine.
For me, it felt like the letter from her sister was where everything shifted. Because the first day is sort of a normal day with her. Then she gets this letter and suddenly she's thinking about, oh no, people think I should remarry. Oh my God, more kids, family other than my son. Like all of that, all those thoughts come through to her. And then that way, the next day, things are just slightly off. And then she gets the package and everything is just completely off.
Yeah, yeah. Did you...
I think I agree. It's that as much as it's any one thing.
Yeah.
I and who's to say that she hasn't had sort of breakdowns, not to this degree, but maybe a cycle of breakdowns or a cycle of things where she has to sort of reset every once in a while. So, yeah, I think it's the letter as much as it is anything.
Yeah. I thought it might have been her son's reaction to the food, because that's the only time where she seemed visibly distraught. Even as she's reading the letter, she's so monotone about, you know, in her inflection. She doesn't seem all that upset about it. But who knows? It could be anything. You're right. As I mentioned, Jean Demon works as a prostitute to pay the bills. What role do you think it played in the story? Like, what is the relationship between the sex work and the housework?
I think it's the same sort of commentary about women and what women do, and one of the jobs that women had to do, and legally in a lot of countries, was have sex with their husband, and you couldn't say no. And so that's just part of women's work, and she's continuing that, and that's how she's keeping a roof over her head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I just see it as a extension of the economic reality that the characters have, because so much this movie is about her day-to-day life, and you ask yourself, okay, her husband's been dead 6 years. She doesn't have, it seems like she doesn't have a, what we would say, a normal job. She doesn't work outside the home. So she has to make an income. So to me, the prostitution is just an economic necessity much as anything.
She also talks about how prior to marrying her husband, she had a job as a file clerk and she was underpaid. She probably, I don't know the situation of women working in Belgium, but oftentimes women are underpaid and harassed. And this is a way where she's in control and she sets what she's getting paid. And so that's sort of, she's just an entrepreneur.
Right.
Yeah, and she doesn't have to go outside the home, so she doesn't have a commute. She doesn't have
dinner and do her job at the same time.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she never judges her for it. It's just another aspect of her life.
Right. I also think it's an interesting like counterpoint to Belle du Jour, where it's like she's the bored housewife who doesn't have anything she has to do, so she becomes a prostitute to like spice up her life because she's bored. And it's like, you know, here's a version of that, but it's not because she's bored. It's because it's essential to being alive, not
and
spiritually.
Sarig, whatever the actress's name is,
Delphine Sarig.
All right, thank you. In The Obscure Object of Desire, the other Buñuel film. So it's like there's another connection there. Anyway.
She's amazing in this film, and I didn't recognize her.
I thought she looked a lot like Julianne Moore.
I could see that.
Well, Julianne Moore is styled to look like her in Far From Heaven.
I saw that. Yeah. I didn't know this. And then I was looking at it, and I was like, there's no way in hell that's not what's happening.
What's happening. Yeah. Todd Haynes has probably seen this movie 100,000 times. Yeah.
It kind of felt like a Serkian melodrama without any of the melodrama.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which was kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this film is directed by a woman, it is DP'd by a woman, it is edited by a woman, it stars a woman, most of the cast were women, and yet it totally defies any stereotype we may have about what kinds of films women make, because there is this total absence of melodrama, near total.
Well, I think the difference that you're talking about is that women's films or women's pictures, melodramas from the classical Hollywood studio era, are almost inevitably made by men.
Right.
So they're not actually made by women. They're just, quote unquote, women's films.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, there's that aspect of it. You know, Douglas Sirk, not a woman.
Right.
George Cukor, not a woman.
No.
You know, so I mean, obviously there are certain stereotypes about what is a woman's picture or what kind of interests the women's filmmakers have. And, you know, just watch some movies by women and then maybe you wouldn't have stereotypes anymore.
Right. Yep.
Right. Yeah. Okay, let's talk. I know we sort of talk about this a little bit, but the rhythms and the pacing of the movie, how does that play into the overall theme? What ways do we establish those rhythms?
What did we say was the overall theme?
Yeah, well, I guess we should talk about that, too. We can start there. What is the overall theme of the movie? I think it's more just an appreciation for this woman and an admiration for this woman and that, well, it may seem trivial to some, like this is important work to her.
It's the work of her life.
Yeah.
It is her life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I particularly like, she only has like one really long speech in the whole movie, and like everything you need to know about her is in that speech. You know, you hear about the Holocaust, you hear about her being an orphan, you hear about her aunt, you hear about everything in this one speech. And at one point she says that she marries her husband partly because he finally doesn't have any money, which I think is hilarious, and partly because she wanted her own life and a son and a child. And generally, especially thinking in 2015 terms, our own life would be our own apartment and our own job and our own car or whatever. But in her mind, her own life would be her own apartment, her own meals, all of those things that we look at as trivial and not important. That's her own life. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was kind of beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, so she's living
her own life.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I feel like she is living the life, even in 2015 terms. If it weren't for the whole prostitution thing, like, I think she's got it pretty good. And the son, get rid of that guy.
But, he's terrible.
Yeah.
No, she could talk about the son. What? She's living the life? This is a celebratory movie? No, that's ridiculous. She lives
give
like...
Give her a Netflix subscription. She'll be fine.
This is like Brissonian level despair. Like, this is not a great...
What does that say about me?
Well, I don't know, whatever. But it's like, no, I mean, I think that there's a, like I said, there's a respect. There's a, for her life choices. But it's like, there's no way that you can look at this woman and say that she's happy and fulfilled.
If she were alive today... She would be a mommy blogger, and she would be making her money with, like, coupons and sponsored posts and things, and she would have a great life. Mm-hmm. I think she would be the happiest mommy blogger.
Born too soon.
Yeah.
101 way to boil potatoes.
Oh, my God. The potato slicing scene is so intense.
It's really – that's a hugely dramatic scene.
God, that scene was fantastic.
See, that's the benefit. That's what we talk about. A long take. Give me that kind of long take over a Birdman any day.
Yeah.
Because it's like
she goes through all the emotions.
Yeah. You just set the camera down and you let the action play out and the tension builds and the audience, it's like that's edge of your seat stuff.
Yeah.
It's when, you know, especially because so much of the film is, you know, quote unquote, nothing happening. And then there's a knife and you're like, well, okay. I know it's just potatoes, but there is a knife there. And it's just, you know, and then every subsequent scene is more and more intense until the finale.
Mm-hmm. When you first saw it, did you have any inkling about what was going to happen?
Yeah, when she gets the scissors out.
Yeah.
But it's, but until then, no. Yeah. Because I had not read anything about the movie and I didn't know that was the whole thing. Where, you know, nothing happens for 3 hours and then she kills a guy.
Right. I was reading a section on Wikipedia called Reception. There shouldn't have been any spoilers in the Reception section. I didn't read the summary section. I read Reception. And the New York Times or somebody in their main review in the 70s or 80s when it came out in America spoiled the ending in one sentence. 3.5 hours and you spoil it with one sentence review? I don't think so.
Yeah.
I was so upset. And I can't unread it.
I know. I'm spoiled as well. And I'm so jealous.
See if it was nominated.
I mean, the good thing about this movie is that 95% of it is about just watching a person perform tasks. And the majority of any pleasure that you get is just from watching that. So, yeah. I mean, the ending is spoiled, but the overall pleasure of watching the movie is not necessarily like, impacted. Like, it's not, like, a huge...
It's true.
...twist or whatever. There's still plenty of stuff there that is good. And then the next time you watch it, you can watch it with that knowledge and then pick up on little details that maybe, you know...
True. But I think at least the first time I saw it, having been spoiled, it was like I was...
The initial tension was gone.
Yeah. The tension. And also it was like I was anticipating, okay, when does she kill the guy?
Yeah.
It's funny, too, because if you just read that she kills somebody, maybe... You know, your imagination fills in what that looks like, because the murder, it's so anticlimactic you can't even call it a murder. Yeah. It's like you have
and
you
that
have
happened. Like, did she murder him because he gave her an orgasm and that pissed her off because she hates sex, or like what? Because that's what I was getting.
Well,
from it.
I don't know about the latter part of that, but the first part, yes.
Like, how dare you give me an orgasm?
I don't know what her reaction is apart from the
or
fact
maybe
that
she
stabs him.
Had an orgasm in so long it like. Flummoxed her.
Well, there are a lot of theories about this, but I guess one of them is just because it appends the regimented order for life. It's something new, much like the, you know, the letter, the package, mm-hmm. the son rejecting, or the son like not eating. Anything that's outside the realm of what she's used to is very upsetting, and obviously that is maybe the most upsetting thing that could happen, because in my mind, it's the prostitution, like I said, it's just economic exchange so mm-hmm. that she can pay the bill, so any element of pleasure in that is obviously very upsetting, because that's not that's not what she's doing it for.
He didn't even look like he was doing a good job.
She was in a weird place.
I think it might have been like, I mean, it's very possible that it was there was a larger than usual psychological component, like, you know, we're at the end of the third day and a lot of things have been going, she's in a very like weird place. This client or whatever, I don't know. And I think it is to, like, getting into, like, the details of, like, I don't know how accurate that was. It's, like, I don't know if that's helpful, because it is, like, sort of more, like, metaphorical. And the fact that you're, like, this is the first time that you
actually see it.
You actually see it and the way that it's shot and, like, sort of, like, being an intruder or being in the bedroom is, like, something that you haven't seen throughout these 3 hours. So, I mean, all of these elements are more important than actually, like, is that realistic? I don't think that's, like, really, like, a helpful way to think about it.
We assume that in the other two encounters she doesn't have an orgasm, but we never actually see it.
Well, yeah, but if we're taking that the fact, the reason that she stabs the guy is because she has an orgasm.
Yeah.
Then obviously
they got out alive those times. Yeah.
I mean, if it's like you look at the way that she sort of conducts these encounters and puts the little towel on the bed, and the bed is never the duvet or whatever is like never rustled. So it's like, yeah, you can kind of, you know, understand, mm-hmm. and it's like very businesslike, and then the men say goodbye at the door. She hands them their coat. Okay, see you next Thursday. It's like, this is not romance, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's pretty safe to assume.
Okay, yeah. I love the use of coats in the movie. She seems to have a new outfit every time she walks into a different room. She has to turn the light on and put on a different coat.
I love her house coat. Mm. And I was so nervous when she left the apartment still wearing it. I'm like, where are you going in that house coat? That's the house coat. You don't ever leave without the house coat, with the house coat on. And then she was only checking the mail, but like at the same time, normally, there's no way in hell she would go check the mail wearing that
it's
house
true.
Coat.
It's how you know.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, there's little signifiers of things not being right.
Yeah. All right. Well, should we get into the list business? This is the listness, 36th greatest movie of all time, according to the Sight and Sound Critics poll. Mariah, I know you hate the poll.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
I'm against it.
Yeah. But is it worthy of the 36th spot? Should it be higher? Should it be lower?
It's in the middle there.
Well, it's tied with Metropolis and Satan Tango, which is
That's high. Those are good.
Those
buddies.
Are very good.
Those
movies.
Are good buddies.
Yeah.
What's the other one? Metropolis and what?
Satan Tango, Bellator.
The Bellator.
I have
the
not
like
seen
eight.
Any
what is
yeah.
it? Like 10, 8 hours,
it's,
9 hours?
No, I think it's like 7. It's
okay,
like 7 hours.
The topic.
Yeah,
for another
yeah,
time.
Exactly. But this film, that's certainly worthy company, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of pressure on this movie, because it's one of, I think, three other movies on the list that is directed by a woman. I believe the others are Cleo from 5 to 7 and Mesh of the Afternoon. So, I don't know. I mean, it should be higher, lower. What do you think?
Well, I think my hesitation for lists like these is that it's not so much a reflection of the films, but the people who compile the films. And I think most people who have seen enough films to be considered able to, you know, put their 10 in for a list like this are generally older. They generally have been watching films for, you know, a long time, and they're like, mostly men, so, and mostly white men, so you get a lot of, like, that taste, and then you have the whole self-perpetuating, like, the Sight and Sound list has been going for 60 years now, right? And the same sort of films keep getting on the list, and it's like, if you drop it off, people go, ah, but it's like, then you're ignoring all of the newer films, you're ignoring the films when women actually got to start making films, but you're also using a set of guidelines that are based on male ideas of what is good cinema, what's important storytelling, et cetera, et cetera. And so it just perpetuates itself. So it's not surprising that there's only three, and it's also not surprising that a film that's like a hymn to the female existence is so low on there. Not that men hate women or anything, but they might not necessarily think, you know what's really important? Films about women. You know, they might be like, oh, yeah, but Goodfellas.
Yeah.
Lots of guns. Yeah. I actually love Goodfellas. Sorry. But you know what I mean?
Yeah. Not all women.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're, you know, it's not going to be a priority.
Right. And this is sort of the default women-directed film.
It's this one and Agnes Varda. Yeah. Like, and then you're done. You're good.
Oh, we got it. It's fine. We put that on there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, lists like these are, they pick canonical, established films. This is the most canonically established film by a woman director, I would say probably above Cleo from 5 to 7. So it's not surprising. It's, although my short answer to the question, should this be on the list, is yes.
Yes.
And is it in a good place on the list? Yes.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, lists suck or whatever, but this is on there. Yeah. And if it gets somebody to watch the movie, then that's great. And if it gets somebody to watch more Chantal Akerman films, that's even better. And yeah, I mean.
Well, I think we'll end it with, it's in a good place.
Yeah.
And there should be more.
I do agree with Kristen, though, that it's like, it's in a good spot. It's in the top third, basically, which I think is legit.
It's good.
Yeah. This beat out a lot of movies that are generally considered, you know, more prestigious.
It's not an easy watch. We didn't really get in. I mean, yeah, Satan Tango's about twice as long as this one. Metropolis is also pretty long. But yeah, it's like, you know, even in the Citizen Kane being, you know, 150 minutes, much easier watch than this.
And also, Chantal Akerman was 25 when she made this. So this is her
Hence the Citizen Kane. Yes. Mm-hmm. I would like, if I had one gripe with the reception of this film, which I think has been very positive, and it is a very high-profile film in terms of international art cinema, but my one gripe would be, why not talk a little bit more about, it wasn't her first film, which
That's
is
true.
Maybe why it's the fact that she made it when she was 25 is not as impressive. Only because she was making baller films like way before this.
I know.
So
just making us look bad.
Catch up, Orson.
Yeah.
Slacker. but yeah, I think there should be a little more discussion because this is I think this film is formally as challenging and as earth-shattering in the international cinema scene in 1975 when it came out as Citizen Kane was for American cinema in 1941. So fight me, bros.
Yeah. In May of 2015, the American Civil Liberties Union made headlines calling for a state and federal investigation into the film industry's gender discrimination. They cited the Center for the Study of Women in Television and Film at San Diego State University. State University. Why is that hard to say?
That's a lot of S's.
Really long sentence.
Yeah.
Center for the Study of Women in Television and Film at San Diego State University study, which indicated that only 7% of all Hollywood movies are directed by women, and only 11% of Hollywood films are written by women. These numbers are the same as they were in 1998. That being said, there are a number of very talented international and independent female filmmakers working today, and our guest, Mariah E. Gates, has made it her personal mission to prove that fact. All right, Mariah, Tell us about A Year with Women and why you started the project.
So, well, one thing, the study, it says that 7% of the top grossing films.
Right.
So part of the project's thing is to show that there are more films available than people are putting their money behind in order to try to bump that number up by people actually buying tickets to the amount of films that are coming out, because there's so many. And they're available, like, on VOD. If you live in LA, you can see at least one, if not three, films directed by women every weekend. So the Year with Women is basically every single film that I watched this year is, the way I put it, was written, directed, co-written, or co-directed by women. But I've actually not really used the written part, partly because there's just so many films directed by women that I wanted to spend my time watching. And the few films that I almost used the written by one, I looked at it and got closer to the release date and was like, no, I don't want to see that.
So, like, Trainwreck doesn't count? Yeah. Okay.
So I'm at 170 films directed by women that I've seen so far this year. It's been very enlightening. And like you said earlier, very much shows that women don't just make romantic comedies. I've actually not seen very many romantic comedies this year, which is sad because I love romantic comedies. And I've seen a lot of just a lot of heavy films. I've seen thrillers and that I'm rambling. So what was the question? Sorry.
So you started the project. You started the project to basically raise awareness about women's films.
And women so who it make was films. It was like twofold. One, to raise awareness that there are so many films available streaming for rent, to purchase, coming out every week. But also because over the last couple of years, because I tend to watch, like, 4 or 5 years ago, I watched 1,000 films in a year, and it was insane, but I also wasn't working. So, you know, it's hard to do that when you have a job. But I still maintain, you know, between 300 and 400 films a year. And it was getting exhausting watching so many films by men, about men, made for men, from a male point of view. Like, I was just hating a lot of what I was watching and going, why did I just spend 2 hours of my life with this characters that I hate? And, you know.
Yeah.
And then I was just not wanting to watch movies. And I live for watching movies, so it was depressing. And then I decided that I would write about so 2 years ago, I was just like every Friday I was writing about a film directed by women to sort of, one, show people films that I love that maybe they didn't know was directed by a woman, or maybe they were seeking more films by women and here's some examples. But then I felt like that wasn't enough. So then I looked on Netflix last June and I found 100 films directed by women. And I was like, okay, I definitely can do this because there's the 100 films just on Netflix. And I work at Rotten Tomatoes, so I know every single film that opens every week because I'm the one that tweets out the score. And there was, like, living in LA, there's usually 2 to 3 films every weekend. I don't make it to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't even afford to VOD all of them because it's, like, $6 a pop, you know? So there's plenty of options if you're seeking it out and paying attention.
If you're a film fanatic, if you are someone who is into film history.
Or a cinema fanatic.
Cinema fanatic, trademark.com. you will inevitably be tasked with watching a certain, like, there are just certain films you must see. Like, as we discussed, like, my whole podcast is about exploring the canon. And the canon is made up primarily of films made by men from a very distinctly male point of view, at least quite a few of them.
Mostly Western.
Right.
You know, I was re-looking at a post that I found that I posted 3 years ago where Scorsese had 85 films that you had to watch to know how to make films,
mm-hmm.
and not a single film on there was directed by a woman. And I was like, Scorsese, why?
Me too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really kind of depressing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were good films on there.
Of course.
I'd seen most of the films he mentioned, and I'm like, yeah, I can see what aspect of filmmaking you think is great from this. Like, he explained it well, but it was like,
yeah, and those are the films that have informed his filmmaking as well.
Exactly.
So that's, I don't want to say it's part of the problem, but it's a lineage, it's a feedback loop that, as a conscientious consumer of media, you should be aware of.
Yes.
Is the fact that if you look to, for example, new Hollywood filmmakers, like a lot of people of our generation and maybe a couple years older than us, look to new Hollywood filmmakers as the be-all, end-all, and then they listen to whatever the new Hollywood filmmakers say have influenced them, that's a lineage of like-minded,
right,
mostly white men who, Americans who are maybe immigrants or second generation, and they're looking to European cinema mainly, maybe some Japanese cinema, not much else. So it's like, yeah, watch those films, but be aware of where that comes from, and then maybe, you know, cast out your net a little wider.
Exactly. It is self-perpetuating.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Obviously.
Yeah.
You just have to be aware of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when did you first become aware of that, like, everything that you love?
Aware of the patriarchy?
Yeah.
You know, I had a year, it was 2 years ago. Like, I've always been pretty conscientious of what I'm, you know, because you don't read a book without knowing who the author is. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people go see a movie without knowing the director. And I always knew directors' names, and I always loved directors. But about 2 years ago, I realized that I was mostly, like, I had one, maybe two films directed by women that I really loved, and everything else was all these men. And then I came up with this list of, like, favorite directors, and it was all men. And I was like, what the hell am I doing? I'm part of the problem. Mm-hmm. And then I saw a couple of films that were really about celebrating women creators and women who were seeking women to emulate and finding it difficult because the previous generations didn't, and they were, like, trying to trailblaze. And I realized that, like, somebody has to do that for women. And there's lots of women doing it. And the more of us that, like, consolidate our efforts together and help each other, the more women directors people are going to be aware of, the more, it's like how this country's stance on gay marriage has changed as the generations have changed, because slowly but surely the younger people are, you know, growing up in a world where it's not terrifying. That's sort of how it is with female directors. It's going to be generations. But if we continue to influence young people and film women who want to make films and girls who think maybe they want to make films but they don't know who to look up to, the more we do that, the sooner, like, 20 years from now, that list, the Sight and Sound list, right, 2020, 2022, it'll be a great
next
list.
Time,
it'll probably have way – it'll probably be way more inclusive.
Right,
it'll be
right,
great.
Yeah. And I think for so long the way men have made films, it's been assumed that the male – point of view or the male technique or the male way of making films is universal. I don't think it ever occurred to anyone that there were people being excluded. And in fact, it was about 50% of the population.
There's this horrible quote from Bret Easton Ellis, which is almost everything he says is horrible.
Yeah. Very on brand for Bret Easton Ellis.
He talks about how he feels like cinema requires the male gaze. He used the term require. And I wanted to be like, the reason he's looking at a history that has been so filtered through the male gaze that there is no other option in his point of view. Like, if women had been making films 50-50 from, and they did in the early days until they started to get shut out because Hollywood started making money. As soon as it was, like, a money-making endeavor, women got shut out. Mm-hmm. If that didn't happen and we had started, the history of cinema was equal from the beginning, we would probably be telling a different story, and that list would be different, and everything would be different. But sadly, we don't have time machines, so we just have to make it different now.
Yeah. And more to that point, I'm reading a book now about the history of early women filmmakers, pre-1920, basically. And before everything became sort of codified, before the studio system came in, and there was this sort of pocket of cultural acceptance and also cultural reverence for female points of view. And what I'm reading now, that there was sort of this very fascinating sort of coincidence of when female points of view were privileged in the society as, like, a societal good. So this is, like, the progressive era, like, when people are, like, striking for child labor and for things like that. And so women filmmakers were considered to be a positive societal benefit. And there was this huge fight over the medium of film to be like, we have to get this out of the penny arcades and the sort of porno cinema attractions, all this, like, gross stuff. And so all these, like, middle class reformers were like, we need to get women in here because women are morally superior to men, which is a 19th century middle-class viewpoint, but that actually allowed women to sort of have a place of power in the very nascent film industry. And then as soon as, like you said, the studio systems came in and things became codified and sort of that progressive era went out of fashion, not coincidentally, around the time when women got the right to vote,
yeah.
That sort of went away. So it's weird how Hollywood history, there are sort of these like pockets of acceptance depending on what's going on with the culture, but then it's always sort of deemed a like just sort of a fad or something mm-hmm. that needs to be like women are needed in certain times, but then as soon as things go back to normal, it's like, okay, we don't need your help anymore. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's
well, and I feel like Hollywood itself knows that it has this problem and it has done a good job of being like having its head buried in the sand. Mm-hmm. The people that didn't know it was a problem for the longest time are your general consumers who, like I said, don't look at directors' names. Mm-hmm. Like cinephiles look at directors' names, but like cinephiles are probably 15% of the box office. Like most of the average Joe who's going to see average Joe films, they want to see the star's name. Maybe they'll know Spielberg, but they don't know like most directors. So they don't know that there's not women directing because they're not paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started doing this, I had several people tweet. I saw several people tweet about because they read about the project, and then they were like, "Wow, I never even looked at who was directing. Oh, I never even thought to think of it." And I'm like, "Of course not."
Yeah.
Because unlike music, you know if you're listening to a man or a woman singing, right? So you can tell if there's like an inequality in your iTunes playlist, right? Yeah. But like with a film, it's so collaborative and you're looking at all of the actors and everything. It's a lot easier to be like, oh yeah, there's 8 men and 2 women acting. Like you can see that equality, but because you don't see the director, you don't see the writer, you don't see any of that, it's a lot harder to know that that inequality is there.
But now that you've watched all of these movies directed by women, do you notice any discernible difference between how women direct and how men direct? Obviously, not all women are direct films in the same way. But
the main thing I've noticed, and this there's data in that same study that backs this up, is that women are more likely to feature women. So it's not as good as you would think. It's not even like 50-50, but it's like in male-directed films, women are like 8% of the speaking roles, and in women-directed films, the average is like 30%. So, but I've mostly been seeing films about women, made by women about women, so that percent has been like really high. So I've seen a lot of women and a lot of actresses, and that's fantastic mm-hmm. because, you know, I love women in every sense. And so that's the main thing I've noticed is like, and occasionally, yes, there's more empathy and there's more of a emphasis on character over action, but there's lots of men that do the exact same sort of thing.
Right.
It's just mostly really been about stories about women, way more stories about women.
Right, right. And I suppose we should talk about the larger societal impact of having basically our entire population has since the 1920s through today only been exposed to movies created by men. I imagine that has informed a lot of how we think about how gender roles are allocated, you know, like what, I mean, I suppose it's like a chicken or the egg sort of thing.
A major breakdown last summer. I like freaked out because I love romantic comedies, and I was looking at all the romantic comedies that I love, and like from the get-go, from like the 30s on, and some of the ones in the 30s, a lot of them are written by women, so that's good, but yeah. Like all of the ones that I love from the 80s and 90s are almost completely written and directed by men, and I was like, everything that I think about that I love, do I actually love it, or do I love it because that's all I know? Mm-hmm. And then I freaked out, and I didn't know how to answer that.
Yeah.
Because there are some romantic comedies, you know, like Nancy Meyers and right. Nora Ephron, et cetera, that I love, but like they're like,
well, some romantic women. Comedies are inexcusable. I don't know. but I think Nora Ephron, she does a pretty good job.
That's because she's a woman. Because
she's a lady.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important point to bring up, just because that they don't necessarily get credit. There were women writing a lot of
this. The first person to win 2 Academy Awards, I think, period, but definitely for writing, was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
It was Frances Marion. And she was writing dude movies.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a badass.
All right.
And she's, like, all but forgotten. I have a master's in film production, and I took a class on film history, and we had a unit on screenwriting. And that's what my focus was. And I was like, oh, are we going to talk about Frances Marion? And she was like, we only have a week to talk about screenwriting. So, and I'm like, she's like the reason we have screenwriting. And this was a female professor. Yeah, and we just didn't, because we only had a week.
In my screenwriting class, the professor brought in a female screenwriter to give a talk. And I won't say what she wrote, but she just casually blurted out, women can't direct. I don't know why that is, but it's true.
I think the same screenwriter came to my screenwriting class.
Really?
We'll have to talk about this afterwards.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
You know, and I think part of the problem with women who have made it is they've had to play a really hard game, mm-hmm. and they've had to be one of the guys, and it's a lot harder to be one of the girls.
Yeah.
And even not just talking about writers and directors, but I was at one of those, like, stupid Hollywood Hills parties where it was all assistants and like underlings, and I was talking to this girl who was a grip, or not a grip,
gaffer.
And she loved it. This is what she wanted to do with her life, but she was about to quit because the sexism on set was so bad and she was so made fun of all the time and belittled that she couldn't function. Mm-hmm. She was like gonna have a breakdown. Mm-hmm. I have a cinematographer friend, same thing. She can lift probably all three of us and this table. And she's like this skinny little person, but she's built.
Yeah.
And, you know, dudes would be like, oh, I don't know, can you lift that? Or, oh. And she, you know.
Yeah.
So it's like you have – the crew is dealing with all this sexism. So you either have women who are, like, being belittled, or you have dudes who are used to being sexist. And then you have to have, like, as a director, you have to have control of that. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to have control of that when – if you yell at them, you're called a bitch. Or if you don't yell at them, your vision's going to get compromised. It's sort of a no-win situation from the ground up.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so much of the Hollywood myth is, you know, dog eat dog, and you have to sort of look out for number one. Those aren't qualities that society teaches women to have. And demonizes women who do sort of take that ethos. So, yeah, it's a boys' club. More so on the production side than, you know,
where you find all the women is in post-production.
Indoors.
Post-production and, like, marketing.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, the feminized spaces of film production. Editing, like sewing, you know, inside a nice air-conditioned room, not out on set where, you know, guys are carrying heavy machines. It's like, you know, it's historical, and it's also, there are... This is a whole history of production histories that predates cinema. You know, it's from theater, it's from factory work, it's from lab tech work, and it's just, it's all, you know, the things that happened 100 and 120 years ago. These are still influencing the spheres of, you know, the spheres of production that we have today. And it's right. Like, because so when you think, and it's like, you think nowadays, it's like, why aren't there, like, female cinematographers? And then you just think about, like, the history, the production history, and you're like, that's why.
Do we see any signs that this is improving? I know I cited that study that suggests that we have completely stagnated, but...
well, the ACLU, yeah. I mean, it's hopefully. Like, that's what it takes.
Yeah.
That's what it took for medical schools to get equal.
Yeah.
And law schools, so...
I mean, that's another thing that people are going to gripe about. Get the government out of whatever private enterprise. Right, right. But you know what? Shut up.
Yeah.
So like if it changes things, actually, if that's what it takes to change things,
yeah.
Investigate away.
Right. You know? Yeah. I feel like Hollywood is just exempt from so many of
because it makes so much money.
Yeah.
When you're talking about that amount of money, carte blanche. Do whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like any systemic change from that business model that's making you billions of dollars, that's scary.
Right.
That's a lot of people's livelihoods on the line. And even if the changes allowed them to make more money, to make bigger profits, or to shrink budgets, which allows them to make more profits, that's scary too because it's an unknown quantity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hollywood is one of the most conservative industries in America, not just politically, but fiscally and in every other way. So it's like there's a when you have so many moving pieces and so much at risk, change is the scariest thing in the world for these people.
I think, like what you said, there's lots of independent cinema. Making a film is so much easier. Getting it out there is so much easier that even if it's not a change within Hollywood proper, there's mm-hmm. so many girls that are not afraid anymore to go. Like, I'll admit that the film school I went to was mostly dudes mm-hmm. and that there were two women in the screenwriting and, like, two women who were in directing out of 50 or whatever. And it was horrible.
Sounds familiar, yeah.
It was horrible. But I like to think that perhaps I'm, like, one of the last generations where that's going to be a problem, because I interact with a lot of youngins on the internet. I mm-hmm. think the bulk of my – because my biggest, like, domain, if you will, is Tumblr, and that's all children now. It used to be 20-somethings, and now it's all high school kids. And I get messages all the time from girls who – maybe didn't think this was an option for them, and now this is what they're going to do, and they're determined, and they see that it's possible because they can see that women have done it. And if you can see that someone like you has done it, you're more likely to try to not let someone not let you do it. So I think the more we shine a picture on, look at the history, look at how many women have done it, even the ones who did it when it was really hard, like Elaine May or Dorothy Arzner, you know, the more women know about that, the more likely they're gonna not let society tell them they can't.
Mm-hmm. All right, I think that's a good place to end that. I'm not sure what fateful late 90s day it was when five very wise British women first rap sang the phrase, "All you need is positivity." But I contend that true words have never been spoken. And so, taking a lead from the Spice Girls, here are today's special girl power-themed final notes of positivity. Kristen, what's one movie, book, song, album, artwork, etc., created by a lady that you've been digging lately?
Anyone who follows me on social media knows what my answer is going to be. And it's the best band in the world, Slater Kinney.
Yay!
So, yes, I will never shut up about it. Just Slater Kinney. The past two or so years of getting into them have been so wonderful, because it's I don't know if it coincided with a happier me or if it actually made me happier, but just a really, really good any mood that you're in, Slater Kinney makes it better. Mm-hmm. So shout out to Slater Kinney.
Yay!
All albums, music, just
what's your favorite
download
album?
It. Oh my god.
you mean put I have me on to the choose?
Spot. My favorite or the best?
Favorite.
Ooh. Okay.
Is it easier to say best?
Yes.
Okay. What's the best?
No. I'm going to say favorite, though. I'm going to go for it. All hands on the bad one.
Okay.
Mm. Okay. So, that's good. And that's the most outwardly didactic feminist album, too. So it fits in with this podcast. So if you're ever feeling like mad at the patriarchy, just listen to All Hands on the Bad One, because it deals with bullshit sexism with girl group harmonies and hand claps and mm-hmm. like really happy sunny things.
I like to listen to that while I'm ironing.
Yeah. Do your housework yes. while listening to Slater Kinney's All Hands on the Bad One. You heard it here first, folks.
All right. Mariah, how about you?
So I watched a bunch of shorts that were co-financed by Miu Miu, the little Prada's.
Yeah.
Yeah, Prada's little baby sister, Miu Miu. And they're all, there's like nine of them. They've been doing them for the last 5 years. I just discovered them. They're between like 4 and 10 minutes long. And they're all directed by like international lady directors. Like Ava DuVernay did one. No surprise, hers is the best one. Miranda July did one. They're all on YouTube. The YouTube ones are better than the ones on their site, because the YouTube ones, there's also a playlist with like behind the scenes where the directors talk about their vision. And why I liked them was they take fashion, and it's obviously their ads for Miu Miu, but they put these like weird feminist spins on fashion. And one of them, like, it's like, what if the clothes became humans, sort of, and they can't communicate because they're actually clothes, and it's like really weird.
Is that the Miranda July one?
No, that one was Lucretia Martel.
Oh, Lucretia yeah. Martel.
But the most recent one that's coming out, and it's actually going to premiere at the Venice Film Festival, is by Agnes Varda. She's going to do one.
Yeah.
Which
Miu Miu?
Now explains why Miranda July and Agnes Varda were in front row at the Miu Miu show.
That's right.
And they took a selfie together, and yeah. it was the best moment of my life.
Because that was like when that photo came out, people were like, how did these people get
right?
together?
At Miu Miu. So Miu Miu is bringing women to the forefront with these ridiculously fantastic short films, and they're all available to stream. They're so much fun.
Awesome. Yeah. We'll link it on the website. Mine is, I've been reading a novel called Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, and it's a sci-fi dystopian future kind of novel. I think it's reasonably popular right now. I'm not. So it's a post-apocalypse. A deadly plague has killed off huge swaths of humanity, and it's about surviving in, you know, without indoor plumbing. I'm not usually really big on sci-fi novels, and they aren't usually written by women. Ursula Le Guin, obviously being the exception. But this one's very readable, and I like it. I'm enjoying it. But I'm not gonna lie, the reason it's my final note of positivity is because there's a huge motif involves a quote from Star Trek Voyager. So I can get down with anything that is really, really fond of Star Trek Voyager. So yeah, Kate Mulgrew quota met. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, do you have any thoughts on Jean Demont? Come tell us on our website, flickswise.com, or you can leave us a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. And if you've got any sweet stain-fighting tips, you can share them with me on Twitter. My handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, be sure to show your solidarity with our cause by rating us and leaving us a comment on iTunes. On our next show, I think some female-helmed FlixWise favorites entries are in order. Some Clueless, perhaps. Trouble with Angels, Point Break. I don't know. You guys in? You up for it?
If you're talking about Point Break, I'm there.
Okay. Yeah, Point Break's pretty great.
So we'll look forward to that. Until then, Kristen, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
And where should people look for you on the internet?
Well, I am the internet, so...
Well, yeah.
just find me on Twitter, @SalesOnFilm.
All right, perfect. And Mariah, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
And where can people find you?
I am Old Films Flickr, pretty much anywhere that you can have a name that's not your real name.
Okay. So, on the Twitter, on the Tumblr?
Twitter,
on the...
Tumblr, movie.
Awesome. Okay.
Facebook.
Perfect. All right, listeners, we're on a strict schedule. It's 2 p.m., time to start a revolution and maybe get some ironing done. Until next time, remember to call your mother.